1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first-person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train. And today, in the studio, the Eagles soar with On the Border.
It's another tequila sunrise, staring slowly across the sky. Said goodbye.
The first 2.5 Eagles albums were made in London, not in L.A. And for a quintessential California band to have gone and recorded Take It Easy, Peaceful Easy Feeling, Desperado, that we recorded those songs in London, I think is sort of funny because they're California records, but they were made in London.
This is Randy Meisner.
And I'm Glenn Frey, in the studio for the album from the Eagles.
Hindsight, it said, is 2020. But looking back also tends to compress time in the same way gravity collapses matter into a black hole. Time and space and dimension can be warped if you try to know the world through a Wikipedia page. A good example is looking at the chart positions of the singles of Los Angeles-based band The Eagles. Based on that criteria alone, starting with their 1972 first album, you could plot a graph that would rise pretty much at a 45-degree angle until by the close of the 1970s decade, with Hotel California and the Long Run albums, the Eagles were America's top-selling band. Except that's not how it happened. And don't take my word for it. Eagles co-founder, the late Glenn Frey, was frank about the band's initial success with three top 20 hits from their 1972 debut album, In the Studio.
But, you know, I really do think that, you know, we were searching in our first album. We didn't really know what we were doing. It wasn't until Desperado that we started to think more about our writing, started to think more about the production, decided to do a concept album as sort of a reaction to our initial success, had sort of set us on an introspective course. And I believe that being associated with David Geffen meant that we were all of a sudden affiliating ourselves with the artists at his management company, who were Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Neil by himself, Jackson Brown. And Don and I sort of looked at each other and said, you know, if we're going to stick around with this company and if we want to be here, we better start writing our butts off. We better start really working on this songwriting and make sure that we're doing good songs. You know, the first Eagles album is very inconsistent as far as the material goes, although it did have three excellent, you know, top 20 singles in it. But we really didn't start to get into the whole deal until Desperado. what Don and I were looking for was to get a producer or an engineer from England where they were getting heavier bass and drum sounds, and to try to, you know, so that we could make country rock records, but they wouldn't be polite and they wouldn't be too country. So we thought it was, you know, we got it in our head that maybe getting a British producer, you know, somebody who'd done The Who and The Stones and The Faces and, you know, some of those kind of records would be the sort of low end production value that we wanted on our records, the bass and drums in particular. So that was why we looked toward Glyn Johns as a British engineer who could, you know, put a little, you know, a little punch in the record production. That was what I meant when I said mistakes. I don't know if they were mistakes or just the fact that, you know, as I say, the excitement live didn't translate to the records.
Here's Randy Meisner.
Yeah, I was very much rock and roll. So was Glenn. Glenn and I really loved rock and roll a lot. And Henley was the singer, you know, more of the ballad kind of thing, which was good. So, you know, the combination of all of us, and Bernie had the kind of country bluegrass kind of vibe. My influence is more R&B. And then with Poco, there's R&B country. You know, I always admired, you know, the R&B bass players. Because I was from Nebraska, everybody thought, well, he has to be country. But I was listening to Wolfman Jack, you know, in Chicago. I get some stations out of Chicago once in a while on my car radio, you know, when the clouds were right. But I also love Motown. I mean, my band, The Dynamics, in high school, we did mostly all Motown songs. We started out doing like Buddy Holly when I was 14, a lot of Buddy Holly songs and Dion and all kinds of. But eventually, it was a lot of Motown attempts and impressions. We loved it.
Seat.
I didn't do anything well when I went to California. You know, I was just, I had only been in copy bands in Detroit. The biggest influence on me was Bob Seger. Bob was a couple of years older than me, and the band I was in got to work a club circuit that was run by Bob's manager, Punch Andrews, who is still Bob's manager. And for some reason, Bob took a liking to me and took me under his wing. Took me to the studio when he was recording Ramblin' Gamblin' Man, let me play acoustic guitar and sing background on it, you know, so I could sort of see how records were made. He did introduce me to a record producer from Motown named Mickey Stevenson. Mickey Stevenson did a few of the Kim West and Marvin Gaye duets and a few other things, and I definitely remember one night at Mickey Stevenson's house in Michigan, you know, listening to Mickey talk about how they stacked the backbeat and how when we have a song, it's not just the snare that hits the backbeat. We put tambourine, hand claps, finger snaps, guitar chinks. We build it like this. And he was sort of went into this dynamic thing, and I just sort of sat there with my mouth open like, oh, God, this is so heavy. But Seger was the person who told me that I had to start writing my own songs if I was going to get anywhere in the music business. Seger was a person who, I remember one night driving around on Woodward Avenue, listening to records in the car, listening to the radio in the car, and like something like the Cow Sills came on. You know, and I reached toward the knob and said, oh, let's turn that crap off. And Bob said, no, wait. They're on the radio and we're not. Let's listen and find out why. You know, even though we don't like them, you know, we should study and figure out how they, you know, how they made a record that was able to get on the radio. So my Detroit days were more influenced by him than by the people from Motown. There was sort of a reverse discrimination going on in Michigan at that time, which was no white artist could get into the Motown studios. So people like Bob Seger, The Rationals, Scott Richard Case, a couple of other local artists who were starting to come up with original material and, you know, ready to make records, you couldn't get into the best studio in Detroit because they wouldn't let anybody in there. So we ended up going to places like United Sound, which was little four-track studios or two-track studios. But so that's, you know, other than my admiration for the Motown stuff, I got into that actually later. It's interesting to point out, you know, sometimes I didn't know how great Motown music was until I got to California and told people I was from Detroit, you know, because I'd heard it all my life, you know, and didn't realize how cool it was outside of the boundaries of Detroit. But it was really when I got to California that I looked back on all of that material and started getting all the records and studying those songs and those songwriters, Holland Dozier and Holland, Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye. It's a very interesting situation they had in Detroit at that time. You know, it was like a musical university where great talented people were competing with each other on a friendly level to see who would get the next Marvin Gaye single or who would write the next thing for the Temptations and produce it. And it's a very fertile time for Motown.
Thank you.
Glenn Frey singing James Dean with the Eagles on 1974's On the Border album. Glenn Frey even admitted to almost giving up on his California dream too soon.
I moved out to California and tried to live there and was sort of intimidated and a little bit scared of the music business and everything that was going on in Hollywood. It was kind of a scary place for me. So I turned tail and went right back to Michigan, only to decide once I got to Michigan that I really didn't want to be there and maybe it would be better to just go out there and take my lumps and see what I could do in California instead of stay in Michigan. I think the original reason I moved to California was because of Life magazine articles of, you know, these jam sessions in Haight-Ashbury where the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead played for free in a park for 40,000 people and there was free love and free dope and, you know, that sort of thing. I think I was definitely caught up in the romance of the West Coast and flower power. Also, you know, sitting in Detroit, an urban environment, and watching the sunset in the west, I never had a desire to go east. You know, I didn't want to go to New York and be in the Young Rascals. I wanted to go to California, have a convertible, and be in the Beach Boys. So I was really sort of seduced by the Golden State, flower power, and, you know, all of those sort of things that were going on at the time. So I went to California.
But the pedigreed players, when the Eagles were formed, were Randy Meisner from Poco and Bernie Ledden from the Flying Burrito Brothers. Glenn Frey and Don Henley had barely 6 months in Linda Ronstadt's band. Someone had to step up to make this thing fly. Again, the late Glenn Frey.
I don't mean this as a knock on Bernie or Randy. Don and I had a tremendous amount of respect for what they had done, and we were very excited to find ourselves in the midst of people who had already made albums and who had already been in good bands. But on the third day of rehearsal for the Eagles, when we were just starting to introduce our individual songs to the collective group and start trying to work through them, I remember riding back to our apartment. Don and I was living with Don at the time. I remember riding back with him in his 68 Malibu and looking right at him and saying, "Don, we have got to run this band or it ain't going to happen." We just sort of, you know, I mean, it wasn't like a power play or anything. It's just that, you know, having had a couple rehearsals with these guys, I mean, I felt that they were good players and good singers, but perhaps that if we were going to get some of the songwriting things together and really, you know, put this thing together right, that Don and I were going to have to sort of have a lot of influence. It wasn't so much that we were going to take over as we weren't going to take a back seat.
Well, my time went so quickly, I went lickety splitly out to my old 55. As I pull away slowly, feeling so holy, God knows I was feeling alive.
Come in up.
Still to come, more startling revelations from original Eagles bass player, singer Randy Meisner, and the late singer-guitarist Glenn Frey. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for the anniversary of the Eagles on the Border.
Hi, this is Randy Meisner.
And I'm Glenn Frey, in the studio for the album from the Eagles. The first 2.5 Eagles albums were made in London, not in L.A., and for a quintessential California band to have gone and recorded Take It Easy, Peaceful Easy Feeling, Desperado, that we recorded those songs in London, I think is sort of funny because they're California records, but they were made in London. The second Eagles album, Desperado, was done, it took us a little longer, it took us 3.5 weeks, and was done for $19,500 because we used an orchestra. So there was the extra couple of days. You know, and although the records were good, you know, Henley and I had always felt like we wanted to spend more time on them, that, you know, that this was all going by too fast for us. Glyn Johns, when we went to mix our record, we found out that our record was going to be mixed the way Glyn Johns wanted it mixed. And he wasn't going to listen to some, you know, long-haired, inexperienced 23-year-old dope-smoking guitar player from Detroit and tell him how much echo he used to put on the background vocals or how loud the kick drum should be or any stuff like that, you know. So we sort of, you know, we worked with a man who was very opinionated, had a path he was going to go on and lead us on, and that's where we went, or, you know, or he was going to bloody well know the reason why. As I say, in retrospect, I wish that we could have spent more time on the records, but also I understand that our inexperience could have perhaps interfered with getting things done. So, you know, there's no right or wrong way to make records. I've made records, you know, that took 2.5 weeks, and I've made records that took 2.5 years. I prefer the ones that took 2.5 years. But that was sort of, that was our experience. I think it was good also to go on the road, and the Eagles continued to go on the road to record, because it was a way to get everybody away from their personal lives so that we could concentrate on making records. And that was the one advantage of going to England, again, was that we were out from underneath the Hollywood microscope. People weren't stopping by the studio to see how things were going. We were really able to go over there in Woodshed and just get the job done.
Down. Oh, well, it's been a good day in hell. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Randy Meisner.
And I'm Glenn Frey in the studio for the album from The Eagles.
And I'm Redbeard. A classic case of be careful of what you wish for because it might come true was Glenn Frey's somewhat naive insistence on selecting an English record producer in general, and in particular, Rolling Stones and The Who recording engineer Glynis Johns. Here's the late Eagles singer-songwriter, rhythm guitarist Glenn Frey in the studio.
I think Don and I were exasperated and frustrated with the fact that we couldn't get enough of our brains on tape and that Glenn was a little bit, he was an immovable object when it came to discussing record production. As I said to you before, when he mixed the first Eagles record and we asked him if there was too much echo on the lead vocal, he said, "It's my echo and it's my signature and this is the way it's bloody going to be." And we just sort of went, okay, I guess that's true. We did make Desperado with Glenn again. Part of the reason was because Ronnie Lane, who was the bass player in The Faces, told us that we still needed someone to oversee our project, that we weren't good enough to do it by ourselves. We said, okay. When we went over to do the third album, we were just totally frustrated. We recorded for 3 weeks in England and only got 2 tracks. We just didn't, none of the other stuff came together. We didn't get any good takes on it. We then ran over to Holland to play a quick show. And in those days, what you did in order to record in England was you told people that you were doing a performance someplace and that you were going to rehearse there, and then we would go in and do the record and then go do the gig and at the end of the project to justify us being allowed in the country. Don and I were not at all pleased with the way our records were being produced, and at that time a fellow named Irving Azoff came in to work at the Geffen Roberts Company to start booking the tours for everybody. David was now the golden boy who was about to become president of Asylum. Elliot Roberts was very much involved with Neil, mostly Neil. And so they needed somebody to book tours for people, somebody to stay there, work the phones, and do the nuts and bolts work. And they brought in this little dynamo from Champaign, Illinois, named Irving Azoff to do the tours. Irving liked us. And we had some conversations with Irving, which were sort of, we're a little bit off in the corner, shoved off in the corner over here. And he sort of said, well, so am I, and I think, maybe I'll manage you guys. I'm getting out of here pretty soon. I'm not going to do this. They've offered me a piece of the company, but I don't want it. I don't want to handhold Neil Young for the rest of my career. I want to do my own thing. I'm going to take Joe Walsh, Fogelberg, and if you guys want you guys, and I'm going to start my own management company.
Let me tell you, I got some news for you.
Already Gone leads off the third Eagles album, On the Border, with a much punchier guitar-driven sound, courtesy of new manager Irving Azoff and producer Bill Zimzik.
He also, by representing Joe Walsh, represented producer Bill Zimzik, who had produced the Joe Walsh and Barnstorm record, which we really, really liked. And then he told us Zimzik also did The Thrill Is Gone by B.B. King, which we really, really liked. And he was doing the Jay Giles Band. We liked some of their stuff, too. So we told Irving that we wanted to change producers, and he suggested Bill Zimzik. So we met with Bill Zimzik at Chuck's Steakhouse next to the record plant on 3rd and sat down and talked with him about record production and stuff and decided that he was the guy for us. He was American. He understood American rock and roll. He was not burned out on electric guitars. And again, I think as you look at the, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you look at the progression of Eagles records, and we start out as a soft rock country band with a couple of rock songs on the album. But with each record, the texture of the music gets tougher. And with each record, the subject matter gets a little more in-depth and a little more topical and you know, a little more, I don't want to say cynical, but, you know, a little more insightful. It was Irving's suggestion to bring Bill Zimzik in. So Bill Zimzik was like a godsend to us. Bill didn't mind letting us work in the studio for 2 or 3 hours on a lead guitar part to get it right. He allowed me in particular and all of us in general to spend a little more time learning about making records, to the point where maybe I spent 3 hours on a guitar solo, and by the time I was done, it was no better than it was when I had just spent a half an hour on it. But how am I to know that if I'm not allowed to explore that extra 2.5 hours? Then I can come back from this experience and say, you know, I do my best work in the first half hour. After that, it doesn't get any more in tune, you know, or whatever. I really am grateful to Bill because he did allow us the freedom to try to get things right, to try to just not play the first thing that came into your head about a guitar solo, but maybe give you 5 or 6 passes at it, and we'll bounce it down to one track, or that started out good, let's punch in there, and what about that lick, and what, you know. We really got into a little bit more of exploring musical possibilities before deciding what was going to go on the record. And that was something we sorely needed. And Bill was also a big rhythm and blues rock and roll freak. And he wanted us to be funkier. We used to have like track of the day where Zimzik could come in. And before we started any work in the studio, Zimzik would play some obscure rhythm and blues song that none of us had ever heard before. You mean you never heard Function in the Junction? You mean you never heard, you know, such and such? And, you know, we studied rhythm and blues records at the beginnings of our session. We take turns bringing in soul tracks and listen to them.
Up next, the Eagles will soar to the highest peak. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of On the Border by the Eagles.
Hi, this is Randy Meisner.
And I'm Glenn Frey, in the studio for the album from the Eagles.
And I'm Redbeard, on the anniversary of the Eagles' album On the Border. In hindsight, the pundits look at the brain trust that the Eagles had and figure that there's no way they could not be anything but the biggest American band of all time. You'll never meet two smarter, more talented, more ambitious people than Eagles founders Glenn Frey and Don Henley. Managed first by billionaire entertainment moguls David Geffen, Elliot Roberts, and then Irving Azoff. But even so, Glenn Frey admitted that everybody needs a little luck in this game.
You know, we had made a pretty significant splash with our first album and the 3 singles that came from it. After that, followed it with a concept album, Desperado, which I think gave us some credibility in the songwriting community, in the music community. And then the On the Border album came out. The On the Border album was more rock and roll, a little more R&B, especially the song On the Border. We released James Dean and Already Gone as singles from that album, and those singles were like what we called at the time turntable hits, meaning they got a lot of spins, but they didn't get above number 25 or 20 in the Billboard charts, never really busted into the top 10. And while we were recording one of these nights at the record plant, a station in Grand Rapids, Michigan, started playing Best of My Love, and the phones rang off the hook. And the DJ and the radio people from this station called our regional guy in Chicago and said, the phones are lighting up on this tune, Best of My Love. It spread to Chicago. It played there for a little while, and then we released it as a single. And, you know, it went to the top of the charts. It became a very, very successful record for us. I think at the time, you know, we were maybe trying to get away from that acoustic, pretty harmonies kind of thing, and we're more interested in, you know, James Dean. But as it turned out, it was the single that started a chain of hit singles that continued until the band broke up. Everything we released from then on was a hit.
Best of my love, the best of my love, sweet darling.
One other funny or interesting little anecdote to Best of My Love. At the time, I was friends with Joni Mitchell. And while hanging out with her, you know, Joni never played a song in standard tuning on her guitar. Every song she's ever written has been in some kind of tuning, whether it was D modal or open E or open G or any other number of tunings that she explored. And it was while trying to get into C tuning, which was something she had showed me, I was by myself trying to remember what that tuning was again, and I got halfway into the C tuning and stopped right there. And so it was like looking for the tuning that she had taught me. I found this other sort of tuning that ultimately ended up being the tuning that we used for Best of My Love. And that was where la-da-da-da-ta, la-ta-ta-ta, that's where that came from. And after I lowered the two strings, I played that, and I never went any further looking for the tuning. I said, this is really cool. Wonder what other chords I can play within this tuning. And then figured out kind of how to wrap my thumb over and play the D minor chord, which was the second chord in the song. And that's how that song was born.
That was co-writer Glenn Frey lifting the curtain on the secrets behind the Eagles' first number one song, Best of My Love. Besides recording close to home with producer Bill Zimzik, another significant development occurred during the making of the On the Border album, according to Glenn Frey.
We were in sort of a quandary in that I wanted to do rock and roll, and Bernie wanted to do country music. And it was okay to do both of those, but what would happen is, on the rock and roll songs, the onus, the lead guitar chores would fall to Bernie, who was a country picker. And on the country songs, where Bernie wanted to sing, it was like for me to do some stuff country, and it wasn't, you know, neither of us were suited to those jobs. So we decided, and the other thing is we wanted to start doing harmony guitar solos. And you couldn't do that and still have rhythm guitar. So it was my suggestion. Don Felder was a friend of Bernie's from Gainesville, Florida. And Felder was up in Boston and came backstage and in the tuning room at the Boston Garden, where I think we were opening for the Allman Brothers on a big benefit or something. Felder sat down and started playing a little, picked up one of Bernie's guitars and put on a slide and started playing like Duane Allman. And I just lost my mind. This guy was so good, and he played all the right stuff, like the Derek and Dominoes kind of playing, and you know, the Allman Brothers live at Fillmore East. He could play all that stuff. And I said, you know, we need to get this guy in our band, and then he can help us do three guitar ensemble stuff instead of two guitar ensemble stuff. And also free me up to sing a little more and not have to worry about covering all the bases. So it was for that reason that we brought Don Felder in. You know, a lot is made about Joe Walsh joining the Eagles, and not to take anything away from the importance of that, but it is my feeling that the addition of Don Felder was one of the key moves that we ever made. He played the great guitar solo on One of These Nights. I think it is worth noting at this time that Don Felder is not only a good guitar player, he is a great bass player. And on the night that we started the One of These Nights album in Miami, Randy Meisner was trying to get to Miami from Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, had to fly through Cleveland. There was a snowstorm. He didn't get in that night. And Henley and I had this song, One of These Nights, which I had written the music for on piano. And we wanted to at least cut a demo of a couple of these tunes. So we gave Felder the bass. And Don Felder wrote the bass part to One of These Nights. I mean, it was unbelievable. And it was so good on the demo that we said, you have to teach this part to Randy because this has got to be on the record. Took him about 2 days to finally get Randy to play it the way he did. Don Felder also wrote the bass part to Hotel California because it was an instrumental demo that he put together himself in his home studio. And again, we said, Randy, you got to play Felder's bass part because it's just too good. Great bass player, great guitar player.
That was Glenn Frey, co-founder of the Eagles, who passed away at age 67 in January 2016 after a brief illness. God rest his soul. Here's Randy Meisner in the studio.
But that was on the border, because that's when we decided we wanted another guitar player. And Don Felder, through Bernie, actually, I think, came into the picture, because Bernie and Don Felder were both from Gainesville. And Bernie had known, and so Bernie suggested Don. And then Bernie got in the group, Don got in the group. And then Bernie felt, I think, for some reason, he was kind of being pushed out of his electric guitar. Because Bernie was, Bernie's like the great flat picker and banjo player. And that's, that was his talent. And he tried to play, he could play leads, electric leads, but they weren't like we were looking more for a Clapton kind of guy,
Pretty mama.
because Fry left us so suddenly, too soon. Chance memories like this next one from 1989 are so precious for original Eagles member Randy Meisner.
I saw Glenn the other day, and it was almost like we hadn't seen each other really, I would say, almost 10 years. And we were eating at this little place in North Hollywood. It's a little kind of breakfast place that a lot of people go to, you know, just old and funky and have good food. And I was sitting there, I was sitting eating with a friend, and he says, there's Glenn Frey. And I thought, yeah, not a chance. I thought he was, you know, kidding me or something. I turned around, and there's Glenn. And it was really good, you know, to see him. And because, you know, we had a little kind of rub there towards the end of the Eagles. And I think it's sometimes, you know, time heals all wounds. And it was great to see him and have a, you know, each gave each other a good hug and talked a little bit. And it really just made me feel good, you know, because I hate holding grudges or anything like that, you know. And it was just nice to see him. And so it was like a big relief, you know. I'm glad this interview is here, that I'm doing it so I can say it, you know.
I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest Randy Meisner, and this edition is certainly dedicated to Glenn Frey. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Remote recording by Jim Nelson. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks, on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.